Well, hello, everybody. Welcome. I'm in Los Alamos, New Mexico, visiting my daughter Kate and her husband Wes and our two awesome grandkids. In fact, I'm lucky. You see, since I'm the preacher, I get to show pictures of my grandkids. So there's Simeon. He just finished saying peekaboo, and he's almost a year and a half. There's Lorraine, who's about 3 and a half, just went off to preschool. And there's Rocket, who's really hoping to get some spaghetti from his brother there, Simeon. So anyway, it's really good to have you here. I want to give a big thanks and shout out to everybody who helped with the Women's Day. Jan kind of headed the whole thing up, but you can guarantee that Joelle did huge quantity of stuff. And Eve and Monroe and Yesenia, as always. And the presentations by the different sisters were super encouraging. We had something like 85, I don't know, 90 women come. And apparently if you're a guy, too bad for you, but you missed something really pretty awesome. Also on the campus retreat, we have a prayer. We have a goal, if you will. Our goal is to get 20 students or maybe some YoPros to take part in the campus retreat on October 24th and 25th. If you'd be praying about that, we really appreciate it. And also on the outdoor service, we moved it back a week. I know we announced it earlier. We did it for about three different reasons. So that'll be fine. That way we can get Eve. The main reason is so we can have Eve there, because we know that bottom line is Eve knows how to help us put on an outdoor service. So we're really looking forward to that. The other thing I'm excited about is just to have Alan do our welcome. And when I heard he's going to do the Lord's Supper, I thought, Josh, that was a genius idea. You know, Alan, he's probably about the humblest guy in the church. And so, you know, he's not Mr. Confident. You know, when he gets up in front of a group, even though they're not even in the room. But Alan is one of the most spiritual guys I know. I'm really looking forward to hearing his Lord's Supper. I haven't seen it yet, but I know it's going to be amazing. Also, thanks to the Chicago Church of Christ worship team. Those are some pretty, that was pretty awesome, right? Pretty awesome singing. So great. So let's do as usual, a little bit of review from last week's lesson. We talked about Jesus and the poor, or possibly Jesus and the wealthy. And we started in Luke 6, 20 and 24, where Jesus says, blessed are you who are poor. And he says, but woe to you who are rich, if you have already received your comfort. And Luke, the poor represent those who are marginalized in general. That could be marginalized by lack of financial capital, but poor in terms of social capital, the outcasts, orphans, widows, people like that. And the rich are, in the context of Luke 6, the rich are not necessarily those who have money. The quote that I gave last week is, the rich are those who with significant resources at their disposal, yet who fail to consider the plight of others. And I think that's those who have woe to the rich. And then we went to the rich fool, who was one of those people, right? And Jesus said, take care, watch out for every kind of greed. And we saw greed takes so many forms. And Jesus explained this through the parable of the rich fool, and he was a greedy man, and he had really two problems, which is number one, he failed to take into account God and his plans, and number two, he failed to take into account the needy and the poor in his plans. So he was a fool. And then we saw the rich man and Lazarus, and this continues this theme in Luke of God having a reversal of fortune. Those who are just doing great, supposedly, in this world, in the future world, they're going to be at the bottom. And those who are at the bottom are going to be at the top. And this man with sores on his body, who was poor and just sitting at the gate of the rich man, just hoping for the crumbs from his table. But in paradise, we know his name. He is Lazarus. And the rich man who wouldn't even look him in the eyes, he's not even given a name. And he's not in a good place. And God says that's how he will treat anyone who is not rich towards God. And then we saw, so that's how God will treat anyone who stores up things for themselves and is not rich towards God. And we know how to be rich towards God from Matthew 25 is by taking the care of the least of these, his brothers and sisters. So today we're going to look at the parable of the lost son. And for once, we're going to look at just one parable. So I'll have time to dig a little bit deeper into that parable. Before I do that, what we're doing here in Luke, we're going more thematic than chronological. And so we're not going chapter one, chapter two, chapter three. But because we're doing that, we could kind of miss the flow of Luke. So I want to do a very, very short aside to kind of figure out where we are in this book, because this is the first sermon we're doing that begins after the transition in Luke 9. So let me kind of remind you of the outline of Luke. In chapters 1 through 3, we have the birth narrative, which is setting up the whole situation of what the gospel is about. It's about salvation coming in the form of Jesus. And then we saw Luke chapter 4 through chapter 9. Is Jesus' ministry in Galilee, in which he's teaching, preaching, and healing. And he's talking about salvation, and he's talking about salvation primarily in terms of God saving us even in this world, even today, especially for the outcast, the foreigner, the women, the poor. And you probably, hopefully remember Luke 4:16-29, in which Jesus says he came to bring good news to the poor, freedom for the prisoners, healing for the sick, and release for the oppressed, and for everybody who will come to him, the favor of the Lord. And that is, in many ways, the gospel in the book of Luke. So now what we're doing is, in Luke 9, there's a transition. So Luke 4-9, the middle of chapter 9, is Jesus' ministry in Galilee. And then in Luke 9:31, we begin to make the transition to the third section of Luke, which is from Luke 9:32 all the way through the end of all the way through Luke 19:27, 10 whole chapters, Jesus is on a journey to Jerusalem. So the transition happens. I don't know if you remember, but in Matthew, the transition happened at Caesarea Philippi, which was at the farthest possible place in Israel from Jerusalem. And that's the place where Peter said that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And from there, also the transfiguration happened, after which Jesus moved towards Jerusalem. Well, that's exactly what happens here in Luke 9. In Luke 9:16-20, Peter confesses Jesus as the Messiah. And then you have the transfiguration in Luke 9:28-30. And then Luke 9:31 is where we make our turn, just like there in Matthew at Caesarea Philippi. But in the case of Luke, the journey towards Jerusalem is a major theme of the entire book. So let's go to Luke 9:31. Again, we're going to get to the parable of the lost son. I'm just trying to sort of help us get the picture of what's happening in Luke so we kind of are aware of the background of what's going on. So Luke 9:31, they spoke. This is right there at the transfiguration. They spoke about his departure. Now, that's interesting. His departure, two kinds of departure. One, his departure for Jerusalem. The other one is his departure to heaven, both of which are going to happen in Jerusalem. All right? They spoke about his departure was about to bring to fulfillment in Jerusalem. And then in Luke 9:44, now is when Jesus, remember, this is the same thing in Matthew and in Mark. Jesus starts to be very specific. I'm going to Jerusalem. I'm going to suffer and I'm going to be killed at the hands of sinful men. And afterward, I'm going to rise from the third day because Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is where he has to die. In verse 44, it says, listen carefully what I'm about to tell you. The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. But they didn't understand. And then Luke 9:51, arguably Luke 9:31 or Luke 9:51, that's the transition verse to this third section in Luke. Let's read Luke 9:51. As the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven. Again, remember Luke 9:31? Again, the time is coming for Jesus to be lifted up on the cross and then later lifted up into heaven. For him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. This is the turning point. The die is cast. The end is near. The death of the Messiah must happen in Jerusalem. Only in Jerusalem can it happen. And then the rest of Luke, there's constant references to the fact that he's going to Jerusalem. You can look up the notes, Luke 13:22, 13:33, 17:11, 18:31. You're not going to have time to write them down. Just constantly comes back to the fact that they're on the way to Jerusalem. They're on the way to the place that Jesus will be killed. He'll be handed over and then he'll be raised on the third day. So this is a major turning point in the gospel. But even as he's going to Jerusalem, the things he was doing before, he's still doing them. He's still ministering to the poor, to the women, to the outcasts in Jewish society. And he's still healing the sick. But there's going to be an ever-increasing amount of opposition from the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, because we're coming to the culmination of Luke, which, of course, happens, of course, in Jerusalem. So now let's get to our text. Luke 11 through 31. Luke 15:11-31. I probably should have caught that mistake. Sometimes it's called the parable of the prodigal son. And I like to call it the parable of the lost son, partly because most people don't even know what a prodigal is. So if you don't know what a prodigal son is, it doesn't really help you as very much to call it the parable of the prodigal son. But I looked up the word. I think I kind of knew what the word prodigal meant. I thought it meant lost, actually. That's not what it means. Prodigal means spending money or resources freely and recklessly, wastefully extravagant. And we're going to see the prodigal person in this parable is actually not the lost son. I'll let you think about that. Who is the truly prodigal one? This is one of my favorite parables. In fact, this may very well be my favorite parable of Jesus, because it tells me so much about God. There's so much theology in this amazing parable. Now, I'm going to do something kind of different. I'm going to use a painting, a very famous painting, as a way to kind of illustrate this parable. I was in the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, and I had no idea this was one of my favorite paintings. I'm not a painting guy. I'm not. I had a girlfriend back in high school and college when I was a long time ago. She was an art major. So I had to kind of get all this exposure to art. And Rembrandt's The Return of the Lost Son has always been one of my favorite paintings. But I remember walking through the Hermitage, which is this great museum there in St. Petersburg. You come around the corner and I'm like, you're kidding. That painting is here. And I spent like a half an hour staring at this. Is, I don't know, the Mona Lisa. If you go to the Louvre in Paris, that's a great one. This would be my other favorite painting. And one thing about Rembrandt's version is you see the lost son and you see the father. But I believe Rembrandt has this parable correct. The two main figures in the parable are the father and the older son. In this parable, we don't really see that much of the character of the lost son. The two we come to understand the best are the father, who of course represents God, and that older son, the one who never left. So we're going to talk about that. So as I go through, we're going to take a little picture of the lost son, and then we're going to take a picture of the father, and then we're going to take a picture of the older son. So the three characters are the lost son, the one who left, the father, and the older son, the one who stayed behind. So let's look, let's read Luke 15, 11 through 20, and let's learn about the lost son. The one is called the prodigal son. Okay, I guess so. All right. Luke 15, verses 11 through 20. Jesus continued. Oh, by the way, let's get the context here. Let's go back to Luke 15, 1 and 2. It says, now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, this man welcomes sinners and he eats with them. After this scene where the Pharisees are criticizing Jesus because he hangs out with the outcasts and the people that nobody respected, and the tax collectors and those sinners, then Jesus told three parables, one of whom is the parable of the lost son. So this lost son in the parable is going to represent anyone who's wandered away from God. But in this parable, it also represents those that the Jewish, aristocracy looked down upon. It represents the sinners and tax collectors and the widows and the women and children and anybody who was not very well respected in that culture. All right. So I said I was going to read the passage, but I'm going to just give a little bit more background here. So in this parable, the lost son is anyone who's become estranged from their father, which means either everybody who's listening to this lesson, either in the past or right now, one or the other. But in the context, it's the tax collectors, the sinners, the dispossessed, the Samaritans, the outsiders in general, who Jesus saw as prodigal, who the Jews saw as prodigal, as profligate, as having wasted their resources on foolish things. All right, so let's finally read this passage. So Jesus continued, there was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, Father, give me my share of the estate. So he divided his property between them. My recorder turned off. Well, I'm sure Monroe has this thing recorded. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had. He set off for a distant country, and there he squandered his wealth on wild living. Can anybody here relate? After he'd spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and he hired himself to a citizen in that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. Nothing against pigs unless you're a Jew, right? He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out. I'll go back to my father. I will say to him, Father, I've sinned against you and against heaven. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. So he got up and he went to his father. A few points I get from this son, this lost son. His frightful presumptuousness. He's the younger son who ultimately will get a third of the inheritance, but his father's still alive. He's still very much alive. And he says, Father, give me my stuff. The presumptuous of this man, the audacity of this man to tell his father, give me my stuff right now. That's amazing. But even more amazing is that the father said, okay. He let him go. You know, really, this son, he's you and he's me. Like I said, he's either you and me at one time, or for some who are listening to this lesson, he's you and me right now. The audacity. I can remember when I was a freshman in college telling my friends God is dead, and I laughed about it. I thought Nietzsche was so awesome when he said that. Doing drugs. Yes, I did that. Partying. And I lived as if God didn't even exist. I said to God, I don't need you. I'm going to strike out on my own. The audacity that we have to tell God that we didn't need him. I don't know about you, but that was certainly me at one time. And I always like to quote my friend Mark Wilkinson. You know, his famous saying was, how's it working for you? How did striking out on your own, taking all the good things that God has for you, and leaving God, and going and wasting those things on wild living, how did it work for you? Did it give you a sense of worth, of value, of purpose, of having a place in this world? Certainly didn't work for me. Again, another thing to notice is how much the Father entrusted to his Son. He entrusted a third of everything he had. And think about how much God has entrusted to us. Our very life. We are a life to him. The breath that we breathe, the air that we breathe, the time that we have, the emotions that we feel, the family that we have, the talents he gave us, and the great sons-in-law that he gave us. Say hello, Wesley. And the grandchildren. The freedom. The fact that we have a free will. That we have self-awareness and the beautiful world that we live in. God has been profligate with us. He has given us so much. But what did this man do? He did what so much of us did. He squandered it, right? And you know, in verse 13, it says that he went to a distant country, because when you're trying to do the wrong thing, you get as far away from your parents as you can, right? And a lot of us, that's exactly what we did, all right? You know, we want to get away, and partly, you know, it's the natural thing of growing up. You want to establish yourself as an independent person, and that's not bad, not really. But you know what? If you want to get into sin and do things that you're not exactly, proud of, you want to get as far away as possible. So he went to a far country. In the context of this parable, that would mean he went to a Gentile place where there were no Jews around to kind of check up on what he was doing. And that's what a lot of us did. Some of you didn't. Some of you didn't go quite as far away from, I guess some form of righteous living. Some of you were maybe a little bit more like the older brother. But I know a lot of us, we went to a far country and we squandered all those amazing gifts God had given us on foolishness. That's what I did. And like I said, some of us are doing, he was lost. He was truly and utterly lost. And that's where we found ourselves, folks, in a pig pen. Yeah, we were in a pig pen. And to a Jewish person, it's hard to imagine a worse place to end up than in a pig pen. Because pigs were unclean to them, right? We, at one time, every one of us was truly and completely, utterly lost. Like the man in that picture saying, how did I get here? Well, let's ask ourselves the question, who put us there? We put ourselves there when we left God. We thought that if we were on our own and he gave us the stuff, we could multiply it. But we forgot that, like it says in Deuteronomy 8, God is the one who gives us the ability to make wealth. But what about spiritual wealth? I mean, this guy realized, I've been foolish. And how low do we need to go? You know, how far do we need to get away from God before we realize, oh my goodness, I'm in a pig pen. Now your pig pen may not have a bunch of corn cobs and slop and mud lying around physically, but spiritually, man, I was wallowing in the slop. That's what I was doing. But you know what happened? He came to his senses. One day he woke up in the pig pen. Just look at that picture. He's sitting there. He's going, how did I get in this place? What did I do? And he started thinking, you know what I did? I left my father. That's what I did. I left my creator. I left my maker. What a fool I am. Now, I've got some good news, folks. Even if you're in the farthest country, in the piggiest pig pen, the process to come back to God, it's not complicated. You know, we just finished a series of lessons just 2 weeks ago. Repent, return, restore, rebuild. And repent and return is what it takes on our part. And God does the restoring and the rebuilding. And so that really this lesson is really well taught through those books that we went through a few weeks ago. He came to his senses. He decided to start thinking common sense. Who really loves me? Who's the one who really cared about me? Who's the only one who ever had my best interest at heart? Under any circumstances, it was my father. Now, common sense didn't lead him to thinking that when he goes back, he's going to get a hug and a robe and all that stuff. Nobody would go there. We know that's what's going to happen, but that's not what he conceived of. So you know what? If you have wandered from God, maybe you're not in a filthy pig pen, but if in any way you've wandered away from God, it's simple, folks. You need to just come to your senses. Number one. And number two, you need to resolve to return to God. It's like I said, it's not complicated. If you wander from God, through sin or just in your heart of really not giving him first in your life, then you just need to come to your senses and resolve right now, no matter how far away you are, to start walking towards God. So what did he do? Verse 20, he got up and he went to his father. That's part one. Now, what about part two in this story? The father. Verse 20 through 25. So I'm going to start in the second half of verse 20. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and he was filled with compassion for him. And he ran to his son. He threw his arm around him and he kissed him. The son said to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe. Put it on him. Put a ring on his finger, sandals on his feet. Bring the fatted calf and kill it. Let us have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and he's alive again. He was lost and he's been found. So they began to celebrate. There is so much we can learn about God from this parable. I don't know, maybe I'm just getting emotional right now, but I think we can learn about more about God from this parable than maybe any other place in the whole Bible. This is so amazing. In this parable, of course, the Father is God. Let's look at God. You know what? He let you go. He didn't try to stop you. I mean, he loved you. He gave his best for you, but he didn't try to stop you. Just like when Jesus, you know, when he would say, unless you give up everything you have, you can't be my disciple. He didn't beg people to stay. He let them go. God trusted that his love for you would be enough. That you would come back, not because he begged you or he nagged you or he threatened you. He just believed you would come back because he loved you. And as we look at the story, if we go back to the first part where the son says to his father, hey, give me my stuff. I want to go do my own thing. We're saying to ourselves to his father, don't do it. Don't do it. Look at him. Do you have any idea what he's going to do with your stuff? The father knows. You know what he did? He let us go. He let us go because he loves us. And he would never force us to love him. He wants a relationship of love. Remember that word we've used a few times? Chesed. That family loyalty, that kind of love. So we say, don't do it. Don't let him go. Whatever you do, don't trust that kind of person with all that stuff. But see, that's exactly what God did to you and to me. He entrusted so much of value to us. And then he trusted us. And what did we do? You know, we said, thanks. See you later. Maybe. You see, in this story, the prodigal one is the father. Remember what the word prodigal means? A person who spends money in a recklessly extravagant way. That is what God has done to you and to me. He spent his stuff lavishly on us in a way that common sense says is foolish. Why? Because he loves us. You know, the son comes back and he's rehearsed this story. If you've ever really done something stupid, you know, and you come to your senses and you're going to go talk to that person, you know how you kind of sort of rehearse what, you know, your version of the story and, you know, you partially explain yourself, but you're mainly saying, I'm sorry and blah, blah, blah. And he starts, he wants to give his story and the father says, you know, no. Basically, it's almost like the father's rude to him. No, just quiet, quiet. You're home. That's all that matters. For God, that's all that matters. That, I mean, the sins that we committed, the stupidity, the foolishness, the rejection, the doing this to God. When we come back, God says, I don't care about any of that stuff. Get out the robe and the ring and the sandals. The outsider has been brought back into the fold. The tax collector, the sinner, they've come home. And God says, spare no expense. The fatted calf, we're going to have a party. Because you know what? My son was dead. And he's alive again. That's what God is to us. That's the father that we have. Look at the look on that father's face in that painting. That love, that quiet, compassionate love. And all he knows is, I have my son back again. And he's in my arms. Can you picture God holding you like that? In that compassionate embrace. That's what he does in the Holy Spirit. That's what he is for you and for me. And all we have to do is to come to our senses and return to the Father. And he's waiting. And remember, he saw his son at a distance. What was he doing? You'd think he'd be busy, you know, taking care of the farm, but he always had that eye. God's eye was always watching out for you. As a parent, I think about my two kids who are not faithful right now. And no matter what, the moment, that the instant they decide they're going to come back to God, you know, I'm going to go running to them. And I'm going to put the robe on them because I want that with God so bad. And that's how God is with us. That's how God treated us. Let's go to part three. The older son. Yeah. He's an important part of the story. We need to look at the older son because, you know, hopefully not, but the older son, that could be you and that could be me. Sorry, guys. Let's read Luke 15, 25 through 31. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him, What was going on? Oh, your brother has come, he replied, and your father has killed the fatted calf because he is back safe and sound. The older brother became angry and he refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him, but he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and you never never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fatted calf for him. My son, the father said, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead, and he's alive again. He was lost and he's found. You know, the father doesn't give a bunch of doctrinal stuff. He says, what are you talking about? I've always loved you. When did I stop loving you? But my son has come home. What do you think we're going to do? Who is this older son? You know, he's out working in the field. He's serving his father. But you know what? In this parable, this is the lost son. We call this the parable of the lost son. But the son who's truly lost is the one who never left home. He's the one who stayed home the whole time. Because you know what? That other son, one thing he never forgot, which is that his father loved him. He knew it. He understood in his heart all along that God loved him. So he came back. But the brother, the older brother who had never left, he didn't think God loved him. He served his father out of obedience because that way one day he'll get 2/3 of the inheritance. And, you know, maybe we should give him a little bit more credit than that. I mean, he was an obedient son. You know, I think maybe I could be too critical of him. You know, I think he was probably trying to do what's right. So what's wrong with this son? Well, he stayed home, but he forgot that his father loves him. And this totally reminds us, me, of our lesson this last Wednesday. Hopefully you were there. You can go back and find it at the website. But he forgot Galatians 5:6, which is the only thing that matters is faith expressing itself through love. He forgot Galatians 5 verse 1. It's for freedom that Christ has set us free. Yeah, God wants us to serve him loyally. He wants us to obey. In fact, we need to obey. We must obey. But it was always about love. And you see, the father is really hurt here. the father's not engaging in a doctrinal theological debate. If we don't understand that God loves us, then God's reaction to that is to be really hurt. All these, you know, years of enslaving for you, but God says, you've always had everything. Everything I have is yours. And he's saying, I thought you were serving me because you loved me. I thought you were staying here because I loved you and you loved me. You missed the whole point. And this could happen to us. We could be serving out of obligation rather than because of love. So he became angry. Who was he angry at? He was angry at his brother, but to some extent he'd already written off his brother. He was angry at God, at his father. That could be us, because we've been serving God out of obligation. We've been serving God out of fear. We've been serving God because we hope he'll give us a bunch of stuff. I hope that's not why you serve God. I hope that's not why you came to church today. I hope that's not why you serve the poor or do whatever you do. The only thing that matters is faith expressing itself in love. The other lesson that I did a long time ago on this, I think it's the first sermon I did actually, when Jan and I arrived here in Bakersfield, is in Malachi, where, you know, in Malachi 1, verse 1, where God says, Jacob, I've always loved. And his people said, how have you loved us? You know, you haven't given us that much stuff at all. In Malachi 1:13, and you say, oh, what a burden. You know, for some of us, our service of God has become a burden. It's because we've lost that sense of the love that God has for us. In Malachi 3:14, he quotes them. He says, you say it is futile to serve God. And you're thinking of just wandering off. It's like, you know, I'll give God the requirements. And that's all I'm going to give him. That's what this older son had done. He did everything he was supposed to do except love God, which is the only thing that God ever really wanted in the first place. That's all he ever wanted from us. They forgot about God's love. They forgot about that chesed, the mutual return of love and respect for each other. You know, in this parable, God is speaking directly to you. He says, my son. Notice, the older son, he didn't say, my brother. He said, your son. Right? He didn't even say, my brother. He said, your son. But the father looks at him, he says, my son, everything I have is yours. And that's what God is saying to you and to me right now. God is looking you in the eye and saying, my son, my daughter, everything I have is yours. And my son has come back. You know, we've been evangelizing. We've been loving people. We've been reaching out. And now they're about to get baptized. And you're not fired up about it. Didn't you get it? Didn't you understand how much I loved you? Your brother was lost and is found. Some of us have been serving God more or less faithfully for many, many years. And we need to not lose focus of this parable and what it teaches us. That we're here by God's grace alone, and God has given us prodigally. He has lavished on us so many good things. And what does he want in return? He just wants us to let him hug us. Let him hold us. Let him welcome us home to where we belonged all along. So let us come home to the Father and accept his bountiful love. Thank you very much.